It's not cheating. It is everybody who is involved in the relationship is aware of what is happening, what is going on. Cheating is when you lie. Cheating is when you're hiding something from your partner.
Have you ever seen someone living an amazing life and thought to yourself, how'd they get so lucky? If you are not currently living a life that's on your terms, a life by your design, then this podcast series is for you. This is the More Confidence with Luna Guy podcast. And in this special season, I'm going to be interviewing people who are living a life by design, living a life on their terms. And I'm going to find out once and for all if it is just luck or there's something more going on. Let's dive in.
Jamie, I'm thrilled to have you on this podcast. And there is many reasons for that. And one of the biggest reasons that I have here is that you and I share something that you don't yet know that we share.
That's exciting.
I know. You don't yet know. It's not in my profiles. It's not what I would talk about. And it's something that a lot of people in perhaps our listeners may have absolutely no clue about. And it really is an off the beaten path kind of lifestyle. And something that's got a lot of popularity right now. I've certainly noticed this. But curious, because you are somebody who is living a life by design, because you are somebody who is living life intentionally, I am ever so curious about these three letters. These three letters that get thrown around. Audience is sitting there going, what are these three letters? What are these two women have in common that is, you know, not necessarily something that I'm currently experiencing, but have quite a significant experience in from my last decade-long relationship. The three letters are E-N-M. Can you tell me about what yes. E-N-M means, Jamie? What do these three letters mean?
Yes. So E-N-M is ethical non-monogamy. And what that means is that you are.
What does it mean?
Yeah. So that means that you are intentionally choosing to have relationships that are non-monogamous in nature. Mm. And when we look,
I'm going to talk to you as if I have no clue about this for the sake of the audience. And so, isn't that just cheating?
Great, great question, and I totally get it. Because that's usually the first thing that comes to mind. It is not cheating.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's not cheating. It is everybody who is involved in the relationship is aware of what is happening, what is going on. Cheating is when you lie. Mm-hmm. Cheating is when you're hiding something from your partner. We're not doing that here. And that's where we come into that ethical part of things. Some people will call it either intentional non-monogamy instead of ethical, but essentially it all means the same thing. And it's actually, we're talking about the general umbrella of different types of relationships that could fall underneath it.
Yeah. And even though it has gained a lot of popularity, people might know it as polyamory. That's a word that can exist under that umbrella as far as my experience goes. People may know it from like a sister wife polygamist kind of, religious kind of thing. Is that what it is?
It's not. I mean, polygamy falls under ethical
not multiple wives?
Oh, yeah. All that falls under ethical non-monogamy. If by definition, if we're looking at as long as everybody is aware of what is happening and what is going on, it's all ethical. It all does fall under the umbrella. But polyamory is very different than polygamy.
How?
So polygamy is traditionally one man has multiple wives. And again, there's always like a religious factor thrown in there. Polyamory is when you look at people who are having deep relationships with more than one person. So that includes both men, women, cisgender, whoever is involved has multiple relationships on a deeper level than you would say a friendship.
Yeah. So that includes sex.
It can. It might not though either. That's the beautiful thing. Mm. It could involve sex. It could involve multiple sex.
That feeling, Jamie. Yeah, there's almost can be a confusion around that. It's like, well, in traditional relationships, in monogamous relationships, I think that a lot of people would define the difference between monogamous and, or, you know, sorry, a friend and a partner is the sex factor.
Mm-hmm.
What would make, what in E&M, in ethical non-monogamy, or in the umbrella of almost relationship anarchy,
yep.
What's the difference? How can we tell that we're in a romantic relationship if it's not sexual?
A romantic relationship is romantically defined by your terms. So how I would define a romantic relationship would be somebody that I connect deeply with, I feel open with, I care for deeply, I love, I enjoy their company, I enjoy cuddling. To me, that is still a deeper relationship than your average friendship. And it would still be a meaningful relationship to me under ethical non-monogamy, and we might not have sex. You don't have to love someone and have to have sex with them. I mean,
that the truth? You know, like it's funny to me, Jamie. I hear what you're kind of saying. People are like, you know, oh, but sex is the defining character of a romantic relationship. And yet, what do they say? There's the statistics are huge that something like 60 or 70% of people in monogamous relationships aren't having sex. So where does that line get crossed? Like if you're not having sex with your wife or your husband, then is that even a relationship anymore?
It poses
the question, doesn't it?
It does. And many monogamous people would turn around and be like, well, no, I am still in a relationship. I am still married. I am still. So you're right. It does pose that question of, okay, when sex is removed, where is the relationship? And I want to make a caveat here that sex in polyamory relationships and ethical non-monogamy is often a part. All I am saying here is giving voice to, it doesn't always have to be.
Have to. It's a path less traveled, isn't it? Because in a traditional monogamous relationship, I remember coming across the terminology and I can't remember, I think it was More Than Two. Is that a book that you are familiar with, a book called More Than Two?
I have heard that one before, but I have yet to read it.
Yeah. So it I can't remember who it's by at this point in time. But the most defining feature from that book that really stood out for me was the relationship escalator that often happens in very traditional monogamous relationships. Do you know, have you heard that term?
Oh, yeah. The relationship, yes. I'm somebody who's been running away from it. So,
yeah, tell me about it. What does a relationship escalator mean?
When we look at, and I might even kind of butcher this because this is all from my own memory too. But a relationship escalator is when we're looking at it, it's usually like, okay, you know, first step is dating, you know, or seeing each other. Second step is dating. Third step is whatever. And you are constantly on an escalator going up and up and up. And eventually you get to a point where you're like, okay, well now here comes marriage. Here comes kids. Here comes mortgage. Here comes, and I mean, those steps are, you know. But the idea is that the idea of an escalator relationship is that in order for it to be a quote unquote real relationship, it's constantly going up the steps. To me, when I even hear and say that out loud, and that's why I was laughing, because I'm like, I constantly am trying to run away from that model because it feels so restricting and gross and yucky.
And I feel like that there's probably a lot of people listening right now going like feeling quite singled out, going, oh, but hang on a second. Isn't that, that's just how it's done. And I think this is so important. It's such a critical piece of ethical non-monogamy in my experience, Jamie, because part of the reason why I went into it, and I'm curious to know yours in a moment, is the fact that I don't just go by the prescribed ideologies of the world, you know, that I want to go find out. And what you were describing with the escalator, there's a life escalator too. You know, if we really think about it, of what the book tells you, like, okay, this is what the book says. This is what I meant to do. This is the blueprint for life. So I go to school and I get educated, and either I, you know, when I leave the end of my, you know, original education, I might move into tertiary education, or I might go get a job and pursue a career. And but at some point I still go buy a house and I do get married and I, you know, I follow the prescription, and then eventually I retire and I have 10 years, if I'm lucky, to enjoy my life before I die.
Right.
It's a life escalator.
Yeah.
Don't you think? It's like,
oh, totally.
I remember before we talked about the 9 to 5, like that prescription of the 9 to 5, which really works for a lot of people.
For sure.
I just want to make caveat here as well that monogamy works for a lot of people, and it's really great for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so does 9 to 5. And I don't think that just because you are monogamous or working a 9 to 5 doesn't mean you're not doing it by design or intentionally. And I've had people on this podcast who are doing just that. So it's not exclusively about that. But it's about questioning what the norms are and whether or not we want it. How did you come across something like ENM?
So I first came across it about 10 years ago when I started exploring some of the subcultures to our different types of lifestyles. And it very much... ENM was one of the ones that came forward the most. Now, 10 years ago, I was not brave enough to explore that personally. I did the research. I was constant and talking to people and going to different groups that are full of people who were polyamorous and asking them questions. And, you know, and 10 years ago, I was in my early 20s, so I was very, very young. I still am.
Wow.
And as my life kind of unfolded, I did meet somebody, I got engaged, and he is and always will be a lovely human, but our relationship wasn't working. And I ended up having to break off the engagement. When I broke off the engagement, I took a big step back and really thought about things. About like, what did I want in my life? What did I want to discover? And what did I want to explore? And I was sitting at home one night and my mother asked me about online dating. And she's like, you know, what is this thing with online dating? And I was like, all right, mom, like here, throw my profile together. There's, you know, my Bumble profile. Go ahead and swipe all you want. And that's how I ended up back in the dating scene. And my mom swiped.
Oh my gosh, how wonderful.
Oh yeah. It was a beautiful night. Very bonding moment for us. And she swiped to her heart's content. And then I started, you know, I was like, okay, fine. People matched. And I was like, great, cool. All right, cool. Maybe I'm ready to start going out there and looking at meeting more people. So I started it. And then what I started noticing in myself was I would meet somebody and we would get along phenomenally. We'd go on multiple dates, but then I was like, oh, still open to meeting other people. And so I would go and meet other people too. And I always had like this rule in my dating books where, you know, if somebody hasn't come to me and asked me for monogamous and for a full blown relationship, I was free to do whatever I wanted. But this time it felt different.
Yep.
I decided to start telling people I was dating other people and be radically honest. And I was like, you know, you're inundated with like ideas of like, yeah, nobody wants that. Nobody like likes that. Nobody. And I was actually greeted with, oh my God, this is so different. Everybody's doing it. You're being honest about it. And so that was my first couple steps into it. And I was like, okay, this feels right. This feels good. I'm checking in with my body. Like, okay, cool. Awesome. And then it kind of just continued on that path. And the really beautiful thing, and I love the fact that we spoke earlier about monogamy is still very much a thing if you're intentional about it. A current partner of mine, my current boyfriend, is monogamous. So he's dating somebody who goes under the – I tend to do relationship anarchy umbrella. And so he's dating, a monogamous person has is intentionally dating someone who is a relationship anarchist and an ethical non-monogamist. And I think, yeah.
A lot of people's brains are getting fried right now, David, because they're sitting there going, how can one person be monogamous but the other person not be?
Yeah.
Tell us how that works.
It works because it's your brain. Like you realize monogamy is you can only like deeply love one individual at a time. And that's valid. That is so valid. Mm. And that is so ingrained into him as a person. And I don't mean to speak for him. We've had lots of talks about this. Mm-hmm. And for me, I know that I am somebody who needs to feel like she's free, but is able to choose who to be with. And there are so many things that I do like to explore. And I do believe that depending on one person for all types of love is actually a for me personally, it is it's a map for failure.
Prescription,
yes. Thank you. Yeah. It's a prescription for failure.
You're welcome.
So
it's really interesting you say that, Jamie, that it's like there's that prescription for failure. I appreciate that. Very often I notice in people's in their relationships, the monogamous ones, that there's this expectation that my partner is going to fulfill all of my needs.
Yeah.
All of them. You know, like sexually, romantically, they're going to be my best friend, that they need to tick every single box when it comes to, well, we need to have the same hobbies and we want to be growing in the same, you know, like there's a hell of a lot of pressure that we put on romantic relationships. And if I would just give the audience some context here, Jamie just mentioned before about being a relationship anarchist, and correct me if I'm wrong here, in the, I suppose the ideology of relationship anarchy is that all relationships can be of equal value.
Yes.
In the kind of current society model is that, you know, like your partner is, and certainly your monogamous primary partner, your husband or your wife, de facto is the most important, or the children are the most important and friends are kind of secondary, maybe family, extended family is secondary or you know, go on like tertiary, go on and, you know, so on and so forth, that there is a hierarchy in relationship anarchy is that it's all can be just as valuable as an important. So, you know, you're not going to drop everything necessarily for your partner if you're with your friend, because you're with a friend and you're there giving time and commitment to them, unless it's an emergency. It's not that the partner always comes first. Is that kind of, have I wrapped that up fairly
well? Yeah. Yeah, so relationship anarchy, there's that. So that was brilliantly put together. And there's also the like I said, the idea of like there is multiple types of love, and like you said, not one person should or fulfill or be expected to fulfill it all, because it's like that idea exhausting to be that everything to one person.
If you flip the script.
Yeah.
You have to be the one that's to everyone. Like it's ideal. Like you're going to be like, if I say, oh, my partner is going to be the one who's going to give me everything. That's one thing. But when all of a sudden now I have to be everything for one person, that's, you know, that's sounds pretty exhausting for me too.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's true for you.
Yeah, it is. It's very true for me, which is why it's so interesting to be in a monogamous relationship with someone that views that is super happy in the moment being with one person. And I don't feel the need to be everything to him. Yeah. But he's like, this is where I'm at. Now, the beautiful thing about this is this relationship is open to grow. Both humans are open to change. And that's what happens. Like, who's to say that, in a couple months' time, he might come forward and be like, I would like to explore other options. And I'd be like, great, awesome. Let's have it. Let's see what that looks like.
And so are you monogamous with him? Is that
no.
It like, so he doesn't date anyone else, but you do?
I do.
Yeah, and yes. that's the framework. So that's the ethical part. That's the consent of the relationship, is that you have both agreed that that is the structure of your relationship.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, I find it really interesting, Jamie. We have a television show in Australia called Married at First Sight. Have you heard about this show?
Oh my God, do I ever like binge it on TikTok? Yes.
Yes, it's quite a phenomenon globally. I never knew this. And then the UK has brought out their own version, all that kind of stuff. Apparently Australia is the most lit version of it. Like, it is wild. Across the globe, people just consume, devour this, the drama of Married at First Sight.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find really fascinating about that show, there's lots of reasons I find it fascinating. Human behavior, relationship dynamics, people's inability to communicate and know themselves. There's a whole bunch that goes on in that. And just, you know, I'm human, love a drama fix. It's really interesting how what people consider cheating,
mm-hmm.
from flirting through to kissing, sometimes kissing isn't considered cheating by some people.
Yeah.
How do you define cheating?
I define cheating as, are you doing something that you don't want your partner to know? That's cheating. So that covers things like if you enter into a financial agreement and you start spending money and you don't want your partner to know, that's cheating. That's financial infidelity. If.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a definition. I'm so glad I asked that question, Jamie, to think that the idea of cheating is betrayal, right? Is like, mm-hmm. are you doing something that you don't want your partner to know?
And yeah.
Again, caveat on that. If you're planning their birthday, it's
yeah.
not cheating. You know, you do want them to know. You just don't want them to know yet.
Yes.
And it's for them in that moment. But
yeah,
like,
yeah. Surprises aside, good surprises.
Mm-hmm. You know, am I watching Game of Thrones ahead of them? Like, mm-hmm. you know, when we committed to doing it together.
Yeah. Well, that's, wow. and that's just it. Like, if you, you know, mm. you might not break up over something like Game of Thrones, but that could be a signal that like, oh, hold up. I was promised something and they're disregarding it. That's a red flag, or at least an orange one.
Yeah. It's a reduction of trust, isn't it? It's a break yeah. of trust.
Yeah,
there's a promise. How do you hold your own? Like in the face, Jamie, that even though to me polyamory, A&M is considerably more popular in the last 2 or 3 years, I've noticed that. Like I was A&M with my partner for 7 of the 10 years that we were together, and we split 4 years ago. So We're talking like a considerable amount of time back now, and now it's kind of popularized. I think that makes me and you a hipster. I think
that's all of us, because
that's
okay.
We did it before it was cool. that now that I see this rise in popularity around it, and more people are doing it, it becomes a little bit more socially acceptable. But I'm not sure what it's like in the, you know, from where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
Is it popular? Is it okay to be that way? Is it okay to talk about it? How do you find in society it's taken?
So I'm lucky that I live in Canada and in, yeah. and in the larger cities, it is becoming more popular and more acceptable. It is also, it is still a little bit shunned, a little bit, you know, some people of the traditional monogamy way may not necessarily want to discuss or accept that side of things. And so, but it is becoming more prevalent. Yeah.
Mm. How do you deal with that? Not just from an A&M perspective, but also, you know, you walk a, you've carved your own path in life in general. You know, it's not, we're not here to just simply talk about A&M, but you, mm-hmm. you're a mind rebel coach, which I love the way that you've described that. And I think it's trademarked as well, but you help clients ease their minds so they can live from their hearts, right?
Yep.
You're wildly in love with life and you're never one from shying away from doing the inner work. You're a transformational warrior and you help break cycles. Even I think that you said that you're a self-proclaimed cycle breaker. You help people reconnect with their authentic selves and gain the confidence to rewrite their own rules and walk life's purposes. That's quite a significant thing to do, to go against the status quo. How have you found in your life, E&M, the coaching that you do, the work and the way that you live your life in general, how have you dealt with society who wants you to fit into a box?
Such a great question. And I want to take a moment and just let it sink in.
Please. Yeah. Take that.
The number one thing that is coming to my mind from that through that question is, where is my own self-respect sitting? And that dictates what I allow in my life. So what that means is I have family members, friends from all sorts of walks of life. And when I decided to step into this lifestyle, both E&M, both as a coach, I said, and I made it very clear to those who were closest to me and my family, what I was doing. And it became I'm not going to sit there judging your lifestyle because I'm changing mine, and I will not allow you to judge mine at the same time. You can ask me questions. Let's have a really great discussion. Let's have respect about where we both stand on our beliefs. But I will not be putting up with any disrespect about it, because it's valid, because I'm valid. And I believe in that.
Thank you for giving that such a heartfelt answer. And I think that piece that really struck home with me there is that I'm valid, that the choices that I'm making are valid, and I won't let you disrespect me.
Yeah.
You and I both know that we can't control how other people, you know, other people's actions. We can't control that. And so you can set the boundary that says, this is how I will be treated. What's the consequence for you? What has it been? Have you had to face any consequences where you had to reduce time with people, cut them out of your life? Have you had to do any of that as you forged your own path?
I think what has happened is that people have naturally fallen away on my path. And yes, things have had to be reduced with certain people, and that's okay. The other beautiful thing is that me showing up in my authenticity as ethical non-monogamy has actually allowed some of my closest friends to learn about the lifestyle and then go back to like, oh my God, I'm really monogamous. I love monogamy, and that's beautiful. So, yeah. And then we're sitting there and we're like sharing and supporting each other in our actual authentic selves. It's removed these veils and these masks for us in the process.
Yeah. More truth, more vulnerability, more self-acceptance, and then therefore more acceptance of one another. You stepping into your authenticity and your power has shown an example and been a model to many of your people. Some are freaked out by that because when you hold the mirror up, people don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But hold the mirror up nonetheless, right? Because some people are going to go, dang, I like that, or I don't like that and I want to change that, or whatever. So I really commend you for your bravery in that, your courage to walk your path. When you were 16, you were nearly fatally killed in a car accident.
Yes.
How do you think that experience has shaped the path that you now walk? I take it that you're around, 30 now, 30-ish?
Yeah.
So it was, half your life ago.
Yeah.
You walk in an unusual path. How has that shaped, do you think?
I remember during my healing process after my fatal car accident. And I was banged up very bad. I was in the ICU for a week. They almost lost me at a point too. But I remember coming back and through the healing process being so annoyed with the BS that people put up with in their lives. And I was so annoyed with the lack of love we gave each other. And just to say, like, I love you. Like, as someone who just almost lost her life, I received an enormous amount of love, which is what I needed to heal. And it was a beautiful thing. However, I made sure to also voice it back. And then I would get angry with, like, it doesn't take someone dying to get this type of love. We have to stop this barrier. And so I started deconstructing that barrier for myself so I could give that to others. And later on.
Oh, what a gift.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then later on, I was like.
Later on what?
Later on, I'm like, oh, shoot. I need to give that to myself. Okay. All right. Let's do that work.
Okay, so you realize that you weren't loving yourself.
No.
So later on you were like, okay, cool, let's bring it all back in and
do it
inward out instead of outward in.
Exactly.
How long did it take you to get from that point of 16, that realization, that almost that annoyance, that frustration of the world going, why? Why does it take someone to die? Why does everyone hear how fabulous they are at their funeral, right? When we could have said it in our living years. How long did it take for you to get to that the next aha moment of I got to do it for myself?
Oh, it was almost 10 years. It was literally almost 10 years. Wow. Yeah, I was in I was 20, 27, 28 when I started realizing and what that actually was. So for me, and this is where I learned about how childhood trauma can shape how we receive and give ourselves love in a tremendous way and on a deep level that we're often unaware of until we start doing that work and start walking that journey. And that is also like, that became a huge part of my story when I became a coach as well, is knowing that and working with, because oftentimes cycle breakers are, have gone through some very traumatic things because something got them to that point. Yeah.
You said that you know, that our childhood traumas, our experiences can really impact the way that we receive love from others and love for ourselves. Tell me more about what does that mean?
What that means is that in your early, especially when we're looking at childhood trauma, in your early years, at a time when you are supposed to be being taught by your caregivers how to regulate your nervous system, how to actually love yourself, take care of yourself, there's something in there that was not given to you or that was taken away from you at that period of time when you are at your most vulnerable. So when you're at your most vulnerable and something is given or done, or in my case, done to me, and then not given the support that I needed as a child to get through that, I became very, you can become very independent. And our minds do this beautiful thing oftentimes when you go through some different types of trauma, that if it's too much for you to take on, your brain will actually do this beautiful thing and lock it so that you have no memory of it. But your body remembers. So that, and when you start doing that work of inner love, that's when things start. It's like your body is like, I'm trusting you now, and I'm going to release this memory. And I know you can handle it to get through it. And now we need to heal this memory. And that's when you start to realize all of your masking, all of your little quirks, all of the things you were doing to survive, because you were not given something that you truly needed as a child. You got it in different ways, and you're constantly looking for it in different ways. So there's also this beautiful journey of massive self-forgiveness that can help in.
Is that what happened to you? Did you, you know, on your journey, there seems there was some sort of fairly significant thing that happened. Was it a big thing? Was it a series of smaller things? Was it a combination of both for you that locked away that part of you as a child?
Yeah. So, and I would love to just put a trigger warning on this, because that not everyone can hear this, mm-hmm. depending on where you are in your healing journey and everything. So I was sexually assaulted as a child at 4 years old. And it was done more than once. And when I actually decided to, like, as a child, you do try and tell people, you act out, you try and nobody was there to help me. Everybody was very busy in their own lives, because there was a lot of other traumatic things happening at the same time, which is why the person who did what they did was able to take advantage of me at that time.
Yeah.
And so when that all kind of bubbles up to the surface, and then I am now an adult saying, okay, I need to give my younger self this voice, and I need to speak my truth. Is that like, you're being met with family members that say, I don't believe you. That's huge. Mm. So yes. And that's a very, like, it's, I can hear it in my voice. It cracks a little, because it is a raw story, part of my story, because it has happened in the last 2 to 3 years, this journey. But it all brings back down to that strength of realizing who I am at a core, because I'm removing those masks. I'm removing those codependencies to get down to who I am and who I came here to be.
At a much deeper level, right?
Yeah, at a much, much deeper level.
Jamie, thank you for sharing.
Thank you for asking.
I can feel, the crack in that. And you know what? For whatever it's worth, I believe you.
Thank you.
That means a lot. I see you. And, you know, like, to what you have gone through and what you have experienced, to be the woman that you are today that's making her choices. And, you know, when we're a child and we don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Because we don't, and we compartmentalize and we have to survive. Whatever it is, something that listeners might consider, quote, big, like trauma with the big T, like you're describing here, or our, for want of a better term, lesser traumas. This is not a comparison of traumas here, but to understand that as children, when we don't get our needs met in whatever capacity for you, you know, safety at that point in time, particularly mm-hmm. as you then wanted to share it, and it wasn't only one time, when we don't get that met, it can absolutely crumble our self-worth and self-esteem, because we rely upon those around us.
Yeah.
So to have you having walked this path, you know, I see you and I believe you and I love you. And as an extension of that, fucking thank you. Like, thank you for being the cycle breaker, Jamie.
Thank you.
Oh. You know, thank you for being so courageous enough to open that memory, mm-hmm. to open the parts of you that had to compartmentalize in order to survive as a child and ongoing, because you weren't believed, and in the most recent years, not believed. Thank you for choosing that path, because it could be a, you know, very reasonable choice to not make that, not like to not take that path. And I say thank you because the gift that you're then able to give to others as a result of that choice is exponential, and it creates the healer in you. So thank you for sharing, and thank you for being the cycle breaker for yourself. Really appreciate it from a global humanity perspective.
Thank you so much, Lenara. That means so much to hear that. And I'm allowing my inner child to also take that in. And for being so brave.
Yeah, talking to her, which is, you know, if I would, for our audience at home, when we're doing that inner child work, it's giving to your inner child what we didn't get from the caregivers. That's what that is. As you know, as far as my work and my methodology goes and what I've done for myself, is when she turns up and her need wasn't met when I was 4 or 7 or 11, 16, 24, 36, you know, it actually doesn't even matter, the, you know, yesterday, if the need wasn't met, can I show up and give her exactly what she needed that the people around me couldn't give her at the time?
Yeah. And as coaches and as healers, that work is so important, because we show our clients that it's doable. That no matter what cards you've been handed in life, or what, you don't have to be that story. You have the choice. You have a choice.
What do you think has been the hardest part of yourself that you've had to, yourself or your patterns or your stories or behaviors that you've had to let go of in order to become who you are today?
I think I'm laughing. Because it's the most prominent one that I have is not being a type A personality. That's not who I actually am, like, authentically.
First, tell us all what a type A personality is, and then tell us that. Tell me more.
Yeah. So a type A personality is somebody, typically, that is someone that has all the answers, knows what's going on, the most organized one. They are like the best go-to person. They know everything. They are prepared for it all. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. Sure. That, like, I had a type A personality based upon my trauma, based upon what happened. Nobody else was there for me. It's a survival mode at this point. And so I developed it. On top of that, not only did I develop it, but when I worked in the corporate world, it was recognized and it was actually praised.
Totally. Look at you go. You're always the one.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's also like ambitious and driven, and like you're always getting it done. You're highly productive. You're so capable.
Yeah.
Look at how capable you are. We can just throw more and more work at you and you still show up, even though you're the duck underneath with your legs going a million miles an hour. You're drowning, but everything's serene up top because it's your trauma response.
Yep. Exactly.
And so you've let that go.
So I have
realized that you're not actually a type A personality.
I've learned that I'm not a type A personality. Now, I will still say that I am highly organized, but I am not, I am not freaked out when I don't have an answer anymore. You know, when I learned something early on from another person, a mentor of mine, where she would say, GTS, Google that shit. So if somebody comes to me with a question, I'm like, you know what? GTS, Google that shit yourself. I'm not your Google.
And that speaks to the unraveling of codependency, the building of your self-worth and self-esteem, because the versions of you that needed everybody else's approval, right?
Yep.
Like, oh, I need you to like me, so I need to be the GTS. Like, I need to be G. Like, Jamie that shit, JTS.
Yes.
Right? Like when we need to feel validated by the external world, then naturally we have to keep the persona to which we have created alive and well. And when we start to bring down those walls, you know, like, well, I'm not that person anymore. Actually... Just so you guys all know, I believed it. You all believed it. I was actually really good at it, but it's not me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Soz, hate to break it to you.
Sorry, that's not me.
I think people are often like people are really often surprised when they find out that I'm not an extrovert.
Yeah.
Right?
I can see that.
I'm like, I'm not.
Yeah.
And they're like, but you're a public speaker and you're podcast host and you
totally
post on social media all the time. And I'm like, yeah. And I recharge alone.
Yeah.
But like, just like you, Jamie, I learnt extroversion or being outgoing if I would. I learnt to be outgoing as a survival mechanism. Oof. That was a mask. That was a front.
Yeah.
That was the way that I built my worth, because if everyone thought I was, you know, happy-go-lucky and outgoing and outrageous and what's Luna going to do next time kind of vibe, and she's going to hold space for everybody at the party, then I felt validated and worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Except on similar to you on that self-discovery journey, it's like, actually, you put me in a social situation at a party and I kind of just want to listen. I might want to talk one-on-one. I can feel uncomfortable in social situations because I'm not that way inclined.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to know what happened when you realized that wasn't a part of your personality and like, you're like, that's a mask.
Oh yeah. What happened? I think it's a slow unraveling. I don't think it's like there was one, like a line in the sand where there was one thing and then another thing. I don't think it was one day I realized. I think it's been a slow unraveling for me. And I think that the sitting in the discomfort, I experience it currently. Like there's a current discomfort that I have around it. The last two or three social events that I've been to, last night being one of them, like that's how current and how fresh it is for me, is that I almost didn't go because I'm not feeling I'm not feeling up. And the my mind would go, oh, I should just stay at home. I should just stay at home because I'm not up and energetic and wanting to connect with all the people and chat and work the room. These days, I'm kind of like, I'm very rarely wanting that. So does that mean I don't have friends? Does that mean I don't go to social situations? There is that the practice of being in the discomfort that I'm going to show up in that social situation
mm-hmm.
and see what it's like to be an introvert in a social situation. See what it's like to just listen and not have to tell a joke or make the funny thing or be the most verbose in the room, which is what I've so often done. So mm-hmm. I think that it's been a practice, like most things, Jamie. It's a slow unraveling and then a practice of, can I love myself fresh-faced without the mask?
Yeah.
Oof. And much like you, I'm committed to that. Can I love myself without the mask on?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes. And the answer is I commit to that process of going, I really want to make sure that I am loving authenticity, not the mask, because when we love the mask, it's not true love.
Mm-mm. I love
Thanks
what you're
asking.
Oh my gosh. So much good tidbits coming out. Even just, can I love myself fresh face?
Yeah. Because it speaks on so many levels, obviously, like women's body image.
Absolutely.
Around, you know, makeup versus no makeup versus, you know, filter, no filter. But can we love ourselves without the personality masks?
Mm-hmm.
Can I show up to that party? Or even, you know, when a friend might ask me, anyway, how are you? And how easy it would be for me to be like, yeah, things are all right. Or can I show up in that moment and say, I'm actually not doing too great.
Right.
You know, I'm not loving things right now. And in those moments where I'm willing, if I would speak personally, when I'm willing to show up authentically, like you were talking before about sharing your E&M lifestyle with your friends, allows them to be more true to themselves. I get to show up and it's often a good test of a friendship for me. Having spent a vast majority of my life, Jamie, holding up a mask and I was the go-to person for everybody, right? Mm. You know, like I'm the emotional go-to. I give all the great advice. But whenever I needed somebody, they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And look, that's partially because of the people that I was surrounding myself with, but also I will own my part in that. If I'm not willing to be vulnerable with anybody, they don't think that I'm vulnerable. So I'm not giving them an opportunity to meet me.
Yeah.
And I think that now it's a good test with my, not testing them, but seeing where these friendships are at. I'm going to give some of my vulnerability. I'm going to see what happens as a result of that. Are we holding space? You know, I've had people in my life who meet me on social media and they're like, wow, I'd love to be your friend, but they actually want to be my client. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you get that too, Jamie, that yeah. It's like that, oh, I just want to be around you and soak up your energy. And to all of you wonderful people listening at home, if you've ever said that to me, it's okay. I forgive you. To be my friend means that you need to be able to see me beyond the social standing.
Yeah.
You need to be able to see me in vulnerability. You need to be able to be okay with the fact that I don't have all my shit together. Even as much as I be authentic online and tell everybody that I don't have all my shit together and I'm often posting fresh-faced and I'm often talking about the fact that I'm having a down day, or I feel like not because I'm complaining but because I want to bring authenticity.
Yeah.
I, you know, there's still this idea of, oh, I didn't expect you to feel like that. And when I met with that from new friends, I'm kind of like, cool. I'm going to give you more of this side of me so that you mm-hmm. know how human I am, because mm-hmm. I can't cruise around you thinking me as a public speaker.
No.
I can't have you being that as my friend. I can't have you just see me as a coach or what I post on social media.
No.
If you're going to be my friend opposed to my client or a fan,
yeah,
I need you to be able to hold me as much as I can hold you.
I think this is – thank you. Thank you so much, Lenaria.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome.
You're so right when it comes to our friendships as coaches.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because it can be really easy to fall into that of people want to get around me because my energy is so great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but are you contributing to that energy?
Yeah.
And I think that's true for anybody, not just a coach or someone who's in a public, as a public figure. I think it's true for anyone. If you have people in your life to which there is not a co-creation, it doesn't mean that I put in 50 and you put in 50. You would know that in your relationship. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's not 50-50 in terms of, well, we always pay 50-50 when we're at a restaurant, or, it, you know, it's 50-50 in terms of I spend 50% at my house and 50% at your house. It's, are we both contributing to the pot that enriches both of our lives? Or is there an imbalance?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, often if there's an imbalance, I need to be paid. Like that's kind of where it comes to. Yeah. Like, yeah, because that's then the exchange that I'm going to hold space and support you. And I'm going to do a brilliant job at it. I'm sure like you would too, Jamie. I'm going to do it so well and you're going to feel so loved. It's not your job to love me if you're paying me though.
Yep, exactly.
But in relationships, I do need something back from that. That's not a monetary exchange.
Yep. Yeah. You need to feel supported in your relationships and you should. We all should. That's right. All deserve it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm feeling like you and I could talk for a long time and I want to, but there's so many questions that I want to ask you. I feel like we need a round two here. So I'm not going to finish up just yet with my final closing question, because I would like to know, what trend or behavior are you seeing in society right now that you think is the most damaging? What are you noticing out there in the world?
Oh, great question. Honestly, it's got to do with this suppression of emotions that's happening. That still continues to happen. This happened in generations that I see of my parents and my grandparents. And it is something that is still happening, is the suppression of emotions, so that you can sit there going, I'm fine. I'm fine. I don't need anyone. It's not being vulnerable. It's not. And it's that separation of our our minds and our hearts. And what it is it's our separation of our emotions. That this is this trend that I continue to see. And to know that you're to work with your, what it means to work with your emotions. Like you can sit there going, yeah, like, I'm really upset that person did that to me. And I can understand why I'm sad about this. And, you know, that's intellectualizing your feelings. That's not feeling them.
It really
that's,
is intellectualizing.
Yeah. That is actually continuing to put the divide between you and your emotions. That's not helping anybody. It's not helping any of us.
Because we're thinking about our feelings, not actually feeling them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow. Thank you. Let's feel more. Mm-hmm. And speaking of, if we are, you know, for the listeners at home sitting there going, I really vibe with Jamie, where can we find more and what do you have on offer?
Yeah. So on that note of emotions, I actually do offer a workbook of just like scratching the surface level of like the best three steps to work with your emotions and align with them, because your emotions are actually your navigation system in this lifetime. They are anchored into your emotions, and you are going to make the biggest transformational moves you've ever made to align, and you, because they are going to be the most aligned. So from somebody who intellectualized her feelings, like majority of her life over here, I learned that the hard way. And then I started learning about that wisdom. So what I do have, because of this, I actually wrote a workbook on how to work, to do this with your emotions. So it's going to be free for your listeners with a code LUCKY. And they can go to my website at walkercoaching.ca, download it there, and take a look at those three steps to alignment with your emotions. Because we need, as someone who intellectualized your feelings, you need to know there's a carrot at the end. What is that? What are you gaining? To do the hard work. And it becomes easier every time you do it.
Oh, what a joy. So we can go to walkercoaching.ca, as in Canada. I'm going to put it in the show notes anyway, so people can have a direct link. Use the code LUCKY and you will get that workbook for free. Is there any other place that we can find you? Walkercoaching.ca for that free ebook about working with our emotions. Any other places that we can hang out with you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram. It's WalkerXOXO. I'm also on TikTok. Same tag. And those are the best places to find me.
Fantastic. What one final question for you today, Jamie, to close out today's conversation. Five final words of wisdom for those pursuing a life on their terms.
Connect.
I've been known to take six.
Okay, cool. Because I'm counting on my fingers here.
But do. I'm the judge.
I think connect to yourself. Connect and get out of your own way.
Nice. And I could even get out of your own way.
That's six.
Connect and that's seven. Maybe I'll change it to 10.
Less than 10 words, yes.
Connect with yourself
and get
out of your own way.
Yeah.
Jamie Walker, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here on the More Confidence with Luna Gaia podcast. And for those listeners at home, please go check out Jamie's work across Instagram and on TikTok, of course. Head to her website, walkercoaching.ca, and grab that workbook that she so generously offered with the code LUCKY. And thank you for being here. Thanks for having this conversation. Thank you for your vulnerability, your shares, the work and everything that you do. Keep on keeping on, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Linaria.
Thank you so much for listening to the More Confidence with Luna Gaia podcast. I hope you feel more confident, more self-assured, and ready to go tackle the world's problems and maybe kick ass in some of your dreams. If you haven't already, I would love for you to like and subscribe, follow, and maybe leave a review so that other people know how to find this awesome podcast too.
If you're wanting to sink your teeth into something even more juicy, my number one best-selling book, Perfectly Imperfect, Your Complete Guide to Loving Yourself and Loving Your Body, is now available on all good bookstore sites, both in print, digital, and I narrated it for Audible as well. If you think that coaching or maybe one of my courses is for you, why not head to www.moreconfidence.com.au and get in touch and see if we can talk. And of course, you can find me all across the social medias. That's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, which is where you're probably listening now, or maybe even here on the podcast platform. Sending you big love and wishing you a beautiful day.